It's all about, like you said, the fact is the fact. You didn't get the job. It's the story you tell yourself and how resilient you're going to be and how much accountability you're going to have into what happens next in your life that separates the pessimist, realist, delusional optimist, and the realistic optimist.
Hi, everyone. Drew Brode here, host of the Broken Brain Podcast. Today, we have my dear friend, Bassam Tarazi. He's the author of a book called The Accountability Effect. A little short and sweet free book. You can sign up for free. Just click on the show notes. A short and sweet manifesto about accountability. It's the book your excuses don't want you to read. And today we're having a conversation with Bassam about why excuses get in the way and what we can do to bust through. I think you're going to really enjoy this conversation. If you have a goal, a dream in life that you want to make progress on, this podcast is for you. Welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast. I'm your host, Drew Brode, and each week my team and I bring on a new guest who we think can help you improve your brain health, feel better, and most importantly, live more. This week's guest is Bassam Tarazi. A child of immigrant parents from Palestine and Holland, Bassam Tarazi is schooled mechanical and nuclear engineer, but currently advises companies on change management. He's the author of 3 books, In 5 Years, You'll Be Wrong, Borders, Bandits, and Baby Wipes, and my personal favorite, which we'll be talking about today, The Accountability Effect. As an entrepreneur, he co-founded the Nomadic... Whoops. I think our team actually miswrote it. It's not Nomadic Film Festival. It's the Nomading.
Nomading. Yeah.
Nomading. Yeah. Yeah, Nomading. Fix that. Okay, perfect. As an entrepreneur, he co-founded the Nomading Film Festival and the Ignition Lab. A wanderer at heart, he's also traveled to over 73 countries and all 7 continents, having had such absurd experiences as getting to Everest Base Camp and the summit of Mount Kilimanjaro, convincing Fidel Castro to sign his passport. I want to hear about that. Living on an Alaskan glacier for over 8 days and being hunted by a pig-tailed... Hang on one second. Okay. And being hunted by a pig-tailed macaw in the jungles of Borneo. He or his work has been featured in Backpacker, Forbes, Young Entrepreneur, Popular Mechanics, and many other outlets. When he's not doing things that he might add to his bio, he's enjoying time with his wife in Portland, Oregon. Bassam, welcome to the Broken Brain Podcast.
Thank you for having me. That was a mouthful. I had to remind myself, was that me? Was that really all me?
That's you, man. So and you got some great stories. Reminds me of, I'm sure you've been compared to the most interesting man in the world.
Some people have said that, and I don't hate it, but yeah.
So, Bassam, we've been friends for some time, and I want to thank our mutual friend, Antonio, for being the one that's connected us. But even before we were friends, I came across an ebook, a free ebook that people can download, and we'll mention where they can get it. And I had heard about you through this ebook that you had put out, which was completely and exactly what I needed to read and hear at the time when I came across it. And that book is called The Accountability Effect. So I want to start off with jumping into this opening phrase that you have inside the book to set us up, and then peel into the layers and the concepts that you teach inside the book for our audience. So I want to start off with one of these opening statements that you have inside the book. So from the time when most of us are young, the question that we hear from our parents or from society often is, what do you want to be when you grow up? And you say that's the wrong question that we should be asking. And it's not what do we want to be when we grow up, but it's something else. Can you kick us off by unpacking that and what the real question is that we should be asking ourselves?
Yeah. Thank you for that. It's a topic that I don't even know if I'd say struggle with, but it comes up a lot in my mind because I feel like the question of what do you want to be when you grow up, it almost allows the asker to ground themselves in kind of what their opinion of you is going to be. Is that answer? Are you an accountant? What box do you fit in, right? What story do you tell from that box? And for me, it's always felt extremely limiting. And it was a description of it was just, to me, it was just a job, right? This what. And I was always fighting, but wait, that's not me. That's not who I am. And so the question that I posed and I thought might help people was, it's not about what you want to be when you grow up, but who do you want to be when you grow up? The whole breadth of who you are, right? What kind of a person are you to your friends, to your family? What do people say about you when you leave the room? What kind of experiences do you want to have in life, right? What are those things that kind of make up who you are, not just the description of maybe your employee or what you do for work? I just always found it so limiting. And so I felt that thinking in that way freed me up to not feel the burden of needing a powerful what to impress someone or to impress a room.
Yeah, I love the distinction between, you know, who versus what. And I think it's a very timely conversation because in the midst of a global pandemic, which could potentially come back and reignite itself, or any major life event, it forces us to question and ask ourselves what actually matters. So when you listen to the conversations that your friends are having now, or what you see out there in the interwebs, how do you think that people are starting to look at that question differently? You know, what do you see that the conversations that are out there, and how are they rethinking their lives in terms of the what versus the who do they want to be?
Yeah, I think the pandemic has reminded us how very little in control of things we are, right? We have hopes and dreams, and we have plans that we set. And in the snap of a finger, it can all change. Now, we can say, but that's unfair. We can be angry. We can be upset. And yet life plods on, and we have to choose what we do. I think what something like this, right? It's almost like an earthquake to our foundation. What it's allowing some of us to do is kind of reset and ask ourselves, well, is this job the most important thing? It's turning out, obviously, a lot of people having to provide at home. And so just defining yourself on your job, it's not who you are as a person. Unfortunately, there are some people who have lost work. And so they are forced in this situation unto no fault of their own. But if you were, say, in the, you know, in the restaurant business, that's not who you are going to continue to be, at least for the foreseeable future. So I think where accountability kind of comes in is, well, hey, I still have a say in this, right? I'm still accountable for my own happiness. So what are some of the things that I do have in my control that I can continue doing and being proud of and purposeful in to help kind of define who I am? So I think the what works fine when everything's fine, right? It's a subset of who you are. But I think people are realizing now that it's not the only thing, and certainly doesn't necessarily need to be the actual driver of how you value yourself in your life.
So what is the accountability effect, and why does it matter?
I would say the accountability effect, and it's funny, you and I had a conversation recently, and I think you put it in maybe the simplest terms. It's this idea of accountability isn't something you have to do, right? When every time we use the word accountable in life, it seems as like, oh, this burden. Who's accountable for this, right? Who's going to be accountable for this? And everybody hides their face. I think what I'm trying to say is, how lucky are we to be accountable, right? To have that choice to say, no, that was my fault, or I got this, and here's why. And leaning in and saying, hey, I'm going to own this, even though I don't know what's going to happen on the other side of that horizon. So the accountability effect is, hey, once you take that first leap in, amazing things start to happen. But it's almost one of those things where it's your move first. And I think so many of us, we try to schluff accountability as much as possible, but keep our life together, right? Keep our status and who we are, but try to take on as little accountability as possible, because with accountability comes ownership. And so I found that the more accountable one is, even if you fail or not, it's kind of like the more self-worth you gain and kind of establish yourself of who you are. And I found it to be contagious. Seeing people who are accountable and who lean in ends up inspiring me in a room. And it's sometimes you just need to see that person lead and prove that everything's okay, even in failure. And a lot of people follow suit right after that.
So then what's the opposite of accountability? What is the opposite and why do people get stuck there?
I think the opposite, of accountability is you cede control, right? You are powerless. You are just a recipient of things that happen in the world. Now, it's sometimes easy to get stuck there because then it's easy to blame everything else, right? You become a victim and it's really hard to back somebody out of a corner of self-induced victimhood, right? It's really hard to get them out if they've convinced themselves that they're there because the world has conspired against them, the world, their God hates them, or the universe is sending them a message. So what you are saying is my efforts don't matter. People or things are against me. There's nothing I can do. So I'm unlucky, right? And then I like to say that the victim and it's hard for people to decipher between between someone who's being a victim or someone who's being vulnerable. And so I always feel like the victim steals the energy that the vulnerable person needs. And so a lot of times with our friends, we're not sure when they're hurting, we can't challenge them. Hey, are you being a victim or are you being vulnerable? Well, you want to support your friend. So I feel like a lot of times it's the victims in life who kind of try to hoard that care, even though they're not willing to do anything to get themselves out of a particular predicament.
You know, you have this great story that you set up and is included in the beginning part of the book about meeting a guy in Haiti. I'd love you to just share and expand on the circumstances that were there.
So we, myself and my boss, I worked for a construction management firm at the time. Believe the major earthquake in Haiti was in 2010, I believe, 2009 or 10. Anyhow, my boss had a connection down there with a nonprofit that was going to rebuild some orphanages down there. So I went with him, I think about a week after the earthquake, and just to do some kind of reconnaissance down there. And obviously, we saw the destruction and pain that was really hard to comprehend. And one of our drivers who we had there was Haitian, and he had lived in the States for a long time, lived in New York. And unfortunately, he got caught up in the law, made a bad decision, got sent to jail for a short amount of time, ended up getting deported. And we were having this moment where we were driving, and there was just kind of chaos all around us. I mean, it was, again, it's just hard to comprehend just the human struggle there. And he just said, look at this. Look at all my brothers and sisters here. We're fighting for food. We have nothing. He said, isn't life crazy? He said, you have a passport that says United States of America on it. I have a passport that says Haiti. You get to leave here and I can't. That's really the only difference between us. And he said, do something with that. Don't feel guilty that you have a U.S. passport, but do something with it. And remember people like me who can't get out of this situation, this opportunity. So it was interesting. And the Haitian passport at the time was also blue. And when you look at it, you're like, man, my little book says United States of America on it. His says Haiti, and how different our worlds are just because of this one little booklet. And it's a moment that really stuck with me and has still stuck with me to these days. Anytime I want to complain about something or feel like, I've been unlucky.
And, there's a couple themes that are in that just one story, right? There's so many cool layers that I'd love to just talk about for a second. So the first one is that if you're listening to this podcast today, that means that you have either a computer or a phone, you're already in some version. It can be a big spectrum, but you're already in some version of privilege and you have resources to be able to, search the internet, probably, which also means that you have economic resources to put food on your table, which means that you have access to education. And most likely, again, podcasting is global, it's worldwide, everybody's situation is different. You're not fighting for the daily survival of your life or confined into a place that's like an extreme economic place of like immobility. I would say for the most part, right? There could be some exceptions that are there. So the first part of that that you expand on in the book, and I've heard you talk about in other places, is that we don't get how good we have it now. Why do you think that's so important for people to remember and realize?
It's a fascinating question. And when you think of human history, not to get into a history lesson here, but for the majority of the length of time that the Homo sapien has been around, called 100,000 years, things have been very, very difficult, you know, and it's been, you know, whether it's hunter-gatherer, whether it's the age of farming, but it was a lot of it was save your resources and be patient, et cetera. And this idea of comfort and convenience was kind of foreign, you know, this idea of just chilling or relaxing and all that. And I think the pull, it's almost like sugar, right? Honey is the sweetest thing in nature. Well, now we can kind of concoct sugar in whatever means we want. And it's really, really difficult. To me, comfort and convenience is like sugar for the brain. And we don't like not having it. It's like a zip tie. As soon as we get a little bit, it's hard to kind of pull back. And so it's really difficult for the quote unquote haves. And to your point, it's, you know, how are you defining a have? I think, you know, a lot of us, like you said, a lot of people listening to this podcast is probably in the have department, meaning we have some free time. We have more conveniences than most. We have access to the internet, et cetera. It's a difficult statement because champagne problems are still problems, right? So it's not telling someone, hey,
everything is relative.
Yeah. It's not telling someone, hey, you're not allowed to be sad. You're not allowed to wallow. But as I used to tell people, you can wallow in a bad day. Just don't wallow in the fact that bad days exist. You know, have that bad day, ride it out. But then, hey, at the next moment, let's get it down to being relative, right? You got to get things out of your system and you still have to process certain things. So I think it's hard, right? I think there's guilt involved. I know that too, as I grew up in the States. You know, my parents came from lesser means, and all of a sudden you have all these things. You're like, wait, I don't do anything necessarily for this. And I think it is just reminding yourself that, hey, I am living with a gift, and it shouldn't be a burden of pressure, but I think like accountability, it should just be, an inspiration of opportunity, you know, is really how one should look at it. Hey, you had a bad day. You had a setback. This thing didn't work. Well, you know what? You still got that roof. You still got that meal. You still have that internet connection, right? You can rise up again. So it's kind of this delicate balance to not tell someone that you can't tell someone that their pain isn't warranted, but it's like, how long do you sit there? And I kind of feel like for me, when I lean into accountability, it's like my trigger for how long I allow myself to kind of be sad about something is pretty quick, right? I kind of am able to process it, deal with it, it passed, have your bad day, sun goes down, okay, Bassam, alarm on the next day, that's a new start. So it's trying to get to those moments where you can kind of have those restarts a little quicker without feeling like, well, everything's fine. Well, you have running water. You can't tell everybody all the time, well, you have running water, you're fine. You have running water, you're fine. No, I think you have to establish, hey, you know, you might still suffer, but it's what are we doing about it, you know, after that initial phase of kind of sadness or displeasure.
Yeah, it's so true. And that's really the second layer. The first layer is like, look, we have access and our life is so abundant. Again, for most people, not that people aren't dealing with real world problems, not that, you know, millions of people have just recently lost their job and probably up to like 30 million in the current state of the pandemic. But to zoom out and say that, all right, well, half the world's population is living on less than, you know, $2.50 right. a day. And then another like billion people are living on less than a dollar a day. So just to take that into context. And then the second component that you brought in, which is, it's not to feel guilty about it or to say, to write off our problems and say, oh, just move on. Like there's people that are worse off than you, right? There's our parents tried that when we were younger. It didn't work that well. Like people don't even have food in Africa and you don't want to eat your Brussels sprouts. Right, it's like when you're a kid, you're like, I know, but they taste like shit. What do you want me to do? But there's something in that that's really beautiful. I want to read a passage from your book because I think you explained it so well here on top of what you've already shared. You said, "We did not ask for this life of abundance, but we have it. The gift was handed to us, soaked in the sweat of generations who fought, clawed, sacrificed, and loved before us. Is that our fault? No. But it was our fault if we throw that gift away. It is our duty to take that gift and the lives and live lives that are benefiting of it. We owe it to those who were born into a life less fortunate through no choice of their own." And I think that that's a beautiful passage because I love the statement here. It is our fault if we throw that gift away. And I think a lot of people feel that they haven't stepped into their purpose, so they don't know what they want to do. Or it's like, sure, I'd be happy to be more accountable if I was actually living the life that I wanted to live. How do we even begin to start down that process of, hey, you're telling me don't throw away the gift. I don't even know what my gift is.
That's a good question. You know, my my father is one of the wisest people I've met. He's a theologian and a scholar and speaks eight languages and was always just very wise. And I remember I was 13 and we had an interaction that kind of sparked that line. And he said, "Bassam, your duty is to live a life worthy of the gift, right? You didn't earn it, but you were handed the silver platter." And I remember struggling with that and thinking, well, what does that mean, Dad? Does that mean like I have to give up everything and help the poor here? Like eventually, do I have to be Mother Teresa? You know, I said, well, right, what does that mean? Do I give up everything? And he laughed. He literally laughed in my face. He said, "You, Mother Teresa?" He said, "Bassam, you could never be Mother Teresa. I'm asking you to be the best you can be." And I know that's a very philosophical kind of statement, but his whole thing, and my parents both would say, just start with one person, right? Just start with how can you help a person and rinse and repeat and start there. And I think we put this pressure on ourselves. Well, Bill Gates is affecting, you know, a continent's worth of people and Mother Teresa, and I can't do that. It's fine. And as I've said, don't change the world, just change the moment. And so, you know, finish that handshake, finish that, well, not handshake anymore, but for right now, but that eye contact, that momentary kindness. And I think it starts there, that you are accountable for the person who's 2 feet in front of your face and how you treat that person, whether they're, it doesn't matter if they're a janitor or a healthcare worker or someone at the checkout counter, someone at the gas station. So I think it's, you know, as the statement goes, how you do anything is how you do everything. And so we can't only care necessarily about the starving in Africa if we're ignoring people in need, even emotional need, or just a hello need, or a that's a lovely scarf need around us every day. And I think we forget how impactful those moments are to just be present to the people around us. So I would challenge anyone to kind of start there. It doesn't matter, quote unquote, what you are in life, or if you have not become who you think you want to be in life, we can still show up every day kind of with kindness and empathy and being accountable for how we treat, you know, each other in this grand dance of life, because I'm sure as you know, and has been spoken many times, we're all fighting, everyone's fighting a battle that we can't see. And so it starts there. And that was something my dad kind of reminded me, like, hey, don't skip the little steps because you feel like, oh, you're not Mother Teresa or Bill Gates. Like, that's a cop out.
You also talk about one way to really get clear about what you want to stand for and what you want to be accountable for is starting with the end in mind. And you have this exercise where you tell people to like think about their obituary and what it would say. Just talk about that and why that's important for us to at least give some attention to.
Yeah, you know, there's, I think in life, we always worried about our resume, but we're never, we don't really think about our eulogy, right? What would someone say at your eulogy, or what would your obituary say? And I think that gets down more towards the who you are. Your resume is kind of what you do. Obituary is kind of who you are. So thinking about that, thinking about how have I treated people along the way? You know, what have people said about me? Are they going to miss me when I'm gone? And we have to remember that those are the things that people will remember about us, not our resume. It's going to be our eulogy. So thinking about what might be in our obituary or eulogy, I think is a way to ask ourselves, you know, am I the type of person that inspires me? And that's really kind of right. You know, inspiration starts with yourself. Before someone else can choose you, you have to choose you. You know, yes, we are inspired by others, but eventually we have to inspire ourselves. So it all starts from this kind of within, not necessarily our external accolades or career achievements, but it's in the how we lived our lives and treated each other. So it is a fascinating exercise when you get somebody to kind of write their eulogy or obituary.
And on a practical level, if somebody wanted to do it, how would they do it? Is this literally opening up a piece of paper and just writing it out? And when you did this exercise, what were some of the things that you wrote for your eulogy? What do you want to be known for so our community can have like an example?
Yeah, absolutely. But yes, it's as simple as that. It's, you know, people, I don't know. I don't know if this is me, but I think maybe we've all had this weird feeling of what if I could see my own funeral and what would people say and who might be crying and who would be there. And for me, it was how would I imagine somebody might eulogize me, whether it's a friend speaking or a family member speaking. And for me, Drew, to be honest, I take a lot of pride in getting people to laugh. I wouldn't consider myself a stand-up comic, but finding a way to have people laugh and bring joy and bring levity to moments, even in discomfort, I think has just been either a skill or something I seek out, even in uncomfortable moments. I'm always wondering, where's the laugh? Far away from home, uncomfortable situation, no money, whatever it is, where's the laugh? Because from the laugh, we can build up, you know, kind of like our accountability from there. So yeah, I think the exercise would be just what would you like someone to say or a eulogy, or what would you imagine a friend or family member would say about you? And I think we all find out really quickly, it wasn't that, oh, Bassam was a Six Sigma black belt, you know, and he really knew how to manage projects. And, you know, none of that stuff is really going to be said. So it's kind of what are you being remembered for in your life? And it's a fun exercise, and it shouldn't necessarily make us uncomfortable. We, unfortunately, you know, we all know we're going to die, but I think it's that moment where we still have a say in that story and how people will remember us when we're not in the room anymore.
You know, pivot for a minute, because there's an essay that you wrote recently, and I think it so ties into accountability. And I want to chat about it for a second. So you wrote this essay recently called Redefining Optimism. And you were really looking at the core crux of like, what is true optimism and what's not? And you put this chart together. For anybody who's listening on the podcast and wants to see it, just click on the show notes. We'll have a link over to this essay by Bassam, Redefining Optimism. And inside that chart, you went through a few different personas that people embody. You know, sometimes when you say you're an optimist, people say, dude, stop being an optimist, you know, be a realist, or, you know, I'm more pessimistic. And you went through those personas and you talked about how they all would handle a scenario in their life. So I'd actually like to walk through this chart and describe it and kind of take a few examples of how people handle challenging news. And then I have a few questions related to accountability at the end of it. So would you mind setting this chart up and give an overview of this essay?
For sure. So I have an affinity for words and how the words we use in our lives actually shape us without us realizing them. So when people say, oh, you're such a pessimist, you're an optimist. Well, what do we really mean by that? And is that word kind of shaping how we're thinking about something without us realizing it? And so for me, I was looking at that and I wanted to kind of go through the progression of one particular scenario. So the scenario I chose were I didn't get a job. So the idea that somebody interviewed for a job and they didn't get it. and there were four versions of yourself who received that news, and how would each of them respond? And so I started with the pessimist. And as a friend pointed out, I didn't realize this, but he pointed out, funny, the order that you wrote those things, Bassam, I went from pessimist, realist, delusional optimist to realistic optimist, he says, was a progression in age and kind of wisdom. And at first, you're a pessimist about it, right? And I said, the fact was, across all four personas, I didn't get the job. And then I add the because, right? Now we need to tell ourselves a story. And for the pessimist, it was, well, I suck and the company sucks. That's why I didn't get it. And then that, to finish the sentence, and so I, right? So why did it happen and what do I do next? And the pessimist is, and so I crawled into a hole and bitched about the world and my stupidity. And so obviously I'm taking a very grotesque version of what a pessimist might say. Next would be the realist, right? Realist didn't get the job because, well, probably a lot of reasons. And so I will apply to a different job, right? The realist is kind of like, meh, tomato, tomato. This happened. I think a pessimist loves the statement, it is what it is, right? It's one of those things where it's just kind of, meh, it, you know, what can you do? And then I get to the optimist. And the big point of this article was the split between what I'm calling delusional optimism and realistic optimism. And I believe that it's delusional optimism has been misconstrued as optimism. When someone says, oh, you're so optimistic. When someone says, I just got a good feeling about it. Good things happen. And you, I believe in the universe. That to me is this delusional optimism. It's more about hope, positivity in the unknown, or, you know, being hopeful. So I didn't get the job because it wasn't meant to be. And so I will put positive vibes in the world for a new opportunity, right? Someone might say, hey, that's the delusional optimist, always looking at the bright side. But for me, I was really interested in, no, what is a true optimist, what I call a realistic optimist? And I'm saying a true optimist is just a realist who knows that she has a say in what happens next, right? That there's some sort of ownership there. So fact, I didn't get the job for the realistic optimist because, well, probably a lot of reasons, right? Similar to the realist. And so I am going to seek feedback, figure out where I can improve, and keep banging that drum, right? There was this willingness to be like, okay, how do I take this information and then find a new path forward as best as I can control without saying that it's solely up to the universe and everyone else. So it's really one of the few ones that brings ownership and, dare I say, accountability into what happens to us and what we do next.
You know, when I saw you putting out this essay, the most immediate thing that I thought of was, this is really a realistic optimist, or a true optimist, as you said in the example, is somebody who fully owns the accountability of the situation. So there's an independent situation that happened, which is the fact, I didn't get the job because, and then you said because, and they all handle it differently. Because is the why. It's our story. Mm-hmm. It's our story that we place on any situation. And a realistic optimist, somebody who fully steps into accountability, is saying, well, I can't know for sure unless if I do know for sure that somebody told me. I can't know for sure. There's probably a lot of reasons. But most importantly, once I decide the why, then comes, okay, what am I going to do out of this? Now that I've given this situation meaning, what do I want to do? What do I want to choose to actually put my effort and energy on? And I thought immediately, like, this is the essence of that book that Bassam wrote, which is Stepping into Accountability.
You know, the funny thing that just came to mind here is, you know, the scientific method, right? Scientists, they're not turned off when their guess is wrong. They kind of take the data and go, huh, all right, how am I going to change direction, right? They had a theory, they hypothesized. But it's funny, in our own lives, we put this pressure that we have to, like, predict and control all the unknowns. And when it doesn't happen, we sometimes, you know, it's too heavy for us. Instead of saying, well, wait, what did I learn? What was in my control? Well, first of all, what was not in my control, right? Certain things at the company, there may have been things that I don't know, but what was in my control? And can I get some feedback on that? And can I control my little part of this universe? Like in any relationship, in any disagreement, right? It's not who's right or wrong. It's just own your part of the drama. That's really all we're saying here is, even if you're 10% at fall. We'll own that 10%. So it's all about, like you said, the fact is the fact. You didn't get the job. It's the story you tell yourself and how resilient you're going to be and how much accountability you're going to have into what happens next in your life that separates the pessimist, realist, delusional optimist, and the realistic optimist.
You've talked in other interviews, and you mentioned earlier about your father and just how wise of an individual he is and his learned background and all the cool things that he's up to. And he's obviously had a major influence in your life. You shared some quotes earlier that kind of came from him and some stories. Growing up, even with a father like that, was there ever a time that you struggled with stepping into accountability or stepping into being a realistic optimism? Were you ever caught up in long bouts with the pessimism or avoiding that responsibility of taking ownership in your life?
That's a lovely question. I would say I would answer that two parts. One, I was the youngest of all, well, I was the youngest of three kids, and I was the youngest out of all my cousins. And so I was a mama's boy, and I definitely was someone who I think looked for that protection at times from my mom. And my mom was an oncology nurse, and she was loving, but she was also kind of tough in that sense. So I think I seeked it as a youngest child, looking for my get out of jail free card because I'm the youngest. But my parents kind of instilled this ability to give trust and accountability before you actually earned it, which was really amazing for a kid, right? It was kind of like, hey, we're already going to trust you, even though you didn't earn it, right? You're going to give you all this rope. And now it's on you to figure out what you're going to do with it. So at a very young age, I realized, instead of kind of like trying to fight my parents, why can't I do this? I want to do this. Well, the parents say, no, oh, my parents suck, you know, this, that, whatever. I had good grades in school and this, that, whatever. So I was kind of free to do, quote unquote, what I wanted. And this relationship between, oh, goodness, if I actually do the things that I'm capable of doing and the expectations have been set for me and I understand, good things end up happening for me. And it also taught me that just because you failed at something or something didn't work out didn't mean you were lesser. It didn't mean anything like that. I think I just learned my parents were like, hey, just don't lie. Just don't lie. Like, we're going to find out. It's way better if you just kind of own up and this happened. So from a young age, I would say I sought probably this comfort and this wish that I didn't have to learn kind of the hard way being the youngest child. I think I sought that safety, but very quickly my parents were able to shape in me and also my elder siblings this idea of, hey, accountability is actually kind of attractive if you play it right. You know what I mean? If you show up, accountability ends up being a wonderful thing in life because people say, oh, okay, you're being accountable. Well, now you can be trusted. Now you are an adult and I can, you know, I'm not going to question you. So I thank both my parents for allowing us as kids to kind of go our own path and to give us that trust maybe before we actually earned it to see what we would do with it.
You know, sometimes I think the opposite or one of the opposites of accountability is hiding. And I think for people that especially grew up in households where you would be punished, there was no sort of positive reinforcement that was brought in for taking ownership of things. And so it's kind of just like, well, I'm going to be blamed for anything, so let me just hide. I'm sure you've met and talked to people since you've written your book who have gone through these experiences, and it shapes you and it makes you kind of who you are. And so you want to be more accountable. You want to take more ownership. You want to lean into your life and really drive it. But there's this hard wiring that's in your system. For anybody that finds himself in that boat, you know, where can they begin to unpack that and unravel it so they can at least start taking baby steps back towards accountability?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I wonder if it kind of almost comes from a worthiness factor, right? I think as, you know, if we've had parents who were a little bit more controlling and told us what we had to do and maybe what we had to study and how we were going to live, it's kind of like, well, I don't have a say, right? Am I even worthy enough to have a say? And I think the simplest route is yes. You know, I mean, yes, especially as we're adults and we kind of are all still living with our childhoods at times. But I think it's convincing yourself that sometimes we're living through the hidden scripts in our life, that we're still living kind of like the childhood realities of things that held us back and kind of what our parents said. But I think like just we sometimes pre-fail. We are failing already in our head of what's going to happen and why would this happen to me? And there's a discomfort in the unknown. And it could be this fear of, well, when I was a kid, when I tried something new or I did something out of the realm and it didn't go well, I got punished or there was a negative kind of consequence. And so for me, I kind of, anytime I'm leaning into something new and I want to take more accountability or take a leap, I really create for myself this kind of worst case scenario. I actually write it down because otherwise my brain and my amygdala will create some insanity, which will say I will be in a drug-induced coma on the side of the road and no one will love me and, you know, I'll die by myself. And it's like, whoa, Bassam, wait a second. What is the worst case in this thing that you want to do or this thing you want to lean out in or be more accountable for? Oftentimes the worst case is really not bad at all, but it's the story we tell ourselves in failing of not being enough or not being worthy to quote unquote succeed. And so I would challenge anyone out there, if you're dealing with a situation of, well, I want to stay hidden because no one really wanted to see who I was and I'm not good enough. It's kind of like really understand the worst case scenario in showing yourself, even in the smallest sense. And you'll find that that worst case scenario is really not as bad as your brain has kind of been building it up in the dark for years and years.
In your journey, you know, in addition to having just a supportive family, what have been some other components outside of your own internal mindset? So it could be books, workshops, other stuff that you've come across that have helped steer you towards the path of taking on more accountability and ownership in your life?
Certainly books. I mean, there, I would say that the individual who probably poked me the most, he wrote a book called Poke the Box, you know, is Seth Godin. He's just very, very quick-witted and sharp with kind of really giving permission. Him and Stephen Pressfield helped me with trusting myself as a writer. I would also say I was very fortunate, and I would say I was fortunate to travel. My family was international, but I 100% sacrificed a lot of things in life, a lot of maybe either personal desires or job roles, et cetera, to explore. And in what I call planned grit, this idea of putting yourself purposefully in an uncomfortable situation or a new situation, a novel situation, foreign country, didn't know, and figuring it out and getting through it and thinking, huh, I did it, right? I got from baggage claim in Madrid. I didn't speak a word of Spanish, got in a cab, got to where I needed to go. There's fire in that. There is an attraction to that. So from a young age, again, my parents allowed me to travel. And then I sought out discomfort in my travels because I thought it was something that built empathy in myself and confidence in myself. So I would say, you know, this idea of what I call planned grit, you don't need to go to Borneo to experience planned grit. It can just be even discomfort in your daily surroundings, be it, you know, a restaurant. Again, restaurants right now are tough, but having conversations with somebody who doesn't necessarily agree with what you agree with. So seeking out some things that you know will be a little uncomfortable, and all of a sudden your empathy and resilience grows at the same time, which is an amazing combination in life. So yeah, I'm certainly a curious one. I read tons. And I try to find the discomfort in my exploration because it makes me appreciate things a little bit more back home. And I feel like it stretches my resilience and empathy.
You know, one of the sections inside the book talks about who helps us become a better version of ourselves. You know, who's in our squad, in our group. How important is who we surround ourselves with when it comes to making us better? Like, what have you seen out there, whether it's research, whether it's your own anecdotes that you toss in? Where does our group and our peers that we surround ourselves with play into this whole equation?
Yeah, I mean, fabulous question. And it's probably, I mean, maybe the most important bit. There was a wonderful book I read early in my kind of self-discovery by Tina Rosenberg. It's called Join the Club. And its subtitle is How Peer Pressure Can Change the World, or something like that. And she went in and studied it, you know, this idea of social proofing, that the number one reason anyone does anything is because somebody else is doing it, right? And the number one thing we want is the respect of our peers. And once you kind of understand that and realize that the people you have in your life are in the business of keeping you, right, to their own definitions and how they describe you, because it's easier for them. Oh, I know Drew. Yeah, Drew's always been XYZ. Oh, Bassam, you know, he's always been someone to do this, this, and this. It's easy for them to describe. Now, if that crew, be they family, friends, coworkers, or whatever, are always kind of being the limiting ones or the ones that describe you in a way that kind of pulls your reins back, it could be for their own gain. They maybe don't want to see you shine, or you shining they feel might impinge on their life. So I've worked really hard to carve out in my life those people who I can support and can support me, and do so unapologetically. I call them sometimes anchor friends. Anchor is so important. When you find them, you hold on for dear life and you do not let go. I tell all my friends I love them, guys, girls, whatever, after every phone call. This idea that, hey, this is a two-way friendship and I'm in this for you as much as I want you to be in this for me. So it's really finding people who can, I don't want to say nurture your flower to bloom, but to make sure that they know kind of what your soil needs and what you're looking for. So again, like I've alluded to, I was very lucky, the dice I was dealt, with having family that allowed me to be and allowed me to kind of figure out what is it I wanted to experience. And then having those friends to support you. And the tough part about all that is, it's you have to curate your friends, you know, like you do a tree or a shrub. Sometimes branches have to be snipped. And I've had friends that I had in high school who I loved to death. And they were some of the best friends I had in high school. But the friendships kind of didn't continue to the level, or, you know, or what we wanted in life changed. I certainly don't like them any less, but as far as the energy I put into fostering those relationships, I realized, hey, sometimes it's run its course. And I like to say, hey, just because a relationship ended, be it a friendly one or a romantic relationship, doesn't mean it failed, right? It doesn't mean that, hey, this relationship, you know, might have served its purpose for a time, but maybe you've changed and you've changed differently to someone else. So I know those are tougher conversations. Sometimes we have that friend, you know, that we roll our eyes and, you know, are these people, like, you know, an energy suck, or are they really building you up? Like our friend Antonio says, are they thieves of glory? Are they thieves of ambition, or allies of glory? And I would recommend everyone to try to surround yourself with those allies, for the people you can call and be vulnerable with and not have to think twice about it. And I'm lucky to have a lot of those that I can pick up the phone and tell somebody, hey, I'm struggling, or why am I worried about this, or here's my deepest fear, and they're there. So I think without that, we end up living in our head for too long, and, you know, life becomes one grand rationalization, and you can convince yourself of anything if you don't have some poignant feedback from people who care about you.
And sometimes people hear that and they're like, wow, Bassam, I'm happy for you. I'm happy for Drew. You guys have amazing friends. Like, I don't have anybody. And I think the first step is, like, we got to be that for other people.
That's
so
right.
Are there people in our lives that we could be that for and kind of create it as a mutual, everybody wins who's a part of that relationship?
Exactly. I think that there was a great bit in the book, Tools of Titans. Laird Hamilton's wife, Gabrielle Reese. Yes, Gabby Reese. She has this great quote where she says her philosophy in life is move first. It's your move first. If you see someone on the sidewalk, smile first, say hi first, right? Be the first mover. Be the first person to do the nice thing. So I think to your point, when it comes to people we admire, it could start as a comment on their blog, right? Maybe you love the way somebody really writes. And yes, they might be in Omaha and you're not, so you might not build a great friendship. But this idea of how can you bring value in their life? What's something, how can you chip in? And if you find that your support group isn't what it needs to be? Like, are there networking events you can go to? Are there places where the quote unquote kind of people who you wish were in your life were? And is there a way, again, to be useful there, to provide value there, and just say, hey, I'm not looking for any help. I am wanting to see how I can help. And one of the tricks actually in networking, I tell people, networking can be quite awkward, and people, you know, are always thinking, you know, well, what do you do? Go to a networking event and kind of think to yourself, you know, what can I do for someone else? And kind of attack it in that way. How can I be of value to someone else? And then, yes, those symbiotic relationships will hopefully, obviously, form over time. But we have to put ourselves in a position to meet those people. Obviously, staying at home all day, every day, and kind of living in our loops, you know, that's not going to happen. So we do have to get out into that discomfort, into what, again, we can call that planned grit, right? I'm planning to go out, and it's going to be something uncomfortable. So find those watering holes, you know, find those watering holes where people who you would think you'd like to rub shoulders with might be. And then, you know, at that point, it's organic at that point.
You know, one of the sections inside your book, you say, you know, ask yourself who makes you better. That's what we were just talking about. Seek those people, you know, like the way that like water seeks lower ground, and nurture them, feed them. And then you add this other layer into here, which I thought was really fascinating when I first read it. And I just, you know, obviously in preparation of this interview, I reread it and just thought how valuable it is. You say, once you've identified them, tell them, like, let them know that they mean something to you, and then beg them to be honest with you, beg them to be candid, beg them to be tough when toughness is what is needed. Why is it so important to ask your friends, your inner tribe, your crew, to have that candor with you and to give you that toughness?
You know, I think for me, and I can speak for me only, I thrive off that, right? I don't want to surround myself with people who are just, you know, a yes man or woman, like, oh, Bassam, that's such a great idea. Like, I'm someone who say, hey, if I'm committing to something, whatever it is, exercise, diet, writing, if I don't, I want you to hold me accountable. Please be there. And so I think if we don't tell people what we want, same thing goes in a relationship. Or if we're only trying to silently tell our husband or wife or partner what we wish they would do or how we wish they would support us, they're never going to figure it out. And it is extremely vulnerable, obviously, to be able to lean into somebody and say, hey, this is what I want this relationship to be. Probably not the best thing to say the first time you meet someone who you think might be a good friend. But I think it's establishing what kind of a friendship you want this to be, right? That this person is growing and you're growing, and you want them there to be your ally. And being your ally means being honest and direct with you. Again, for some people, that kind of toughness and directness works, but telling your friends how they can support you when you're being vulnerable is extremely important, because you are doing something vulnerable. You're launching an online course, you're writing a book, you're starting a business, you're selling your pictures, whatever it is, that's tough. So expressing to your friends the kind of support you're looking for as you walk out in this branch of vulnerability is important, because they can't read your mind. So for me, I do like that kind of tough love. Hey, call my bluff, call me out. And I make that very clear with my friends. So it's nice that that's in the open. They don't have to wonder what's the best way to support me. They don't have to bite their tongue wondering, hey, would Bassam want to hear this? No, they already know I would want to hear it if they're thinking it.
Mm. Can you give us an example of the last time that a friend has leaned in, whether you asked or they just came to you and said, hey, brother, you know, this might be something to pay attention to?
So one of my favorite examples of that, I have a lot, but I think my favorite one is the last book I wrote, which is Borders, Bandits, and Baby Wipes. I wrote it and I had a draft done and I was done. I was mentally done with it. I was like, yep, it's good enough. And I sent it to Antonio, and I remember he read it and he's like, hey, let me know when you have some time for some feedback, right? He texted me and I called him, and Drew, I heard it when he took his inhale on his breath. I'm like, uh-oh, there's some fire coming. Like, and I wanted it. But he said, look, I love you. This book is good, but it's not great yet. And I want you, I think you can make this great. And it honestly changed the course of that book. And whether I can say my life maybe is a bit heavy, but it always was like, I needed to hear that. And I knew it. And I was like hoping he would say it, but maybe secretly hoping he wouldn't, but really wanting him to. And he did. And it was one of those, like, how wonderful of a friend is that to tell you, who just poured your soul into a giraffe, to say, it's good, but it's not great. And I know, you know, it's not great. And so that's one of those things that I think, I mean, there's no, you couldn't put economic value on that. I mean, my wife calls my bluffs all the time, right? If I think I'm being angry for something, I tell her that. I say, hey, look, you can be tough if you think I'm reacting a certain way, or, am I compensating for something? So, I call friends all the time when I feel like I'm struggling with kind of like a work kind of reality. Do I want to, you know, this, that, whatever. And I have friends with Bassam. I've heard you say this before. I feel like we've had this conversation before. You know exactly what I'm going to say. And then I'm like, crap. Yep. I know what he's going to say, but sometimes we just need to hear it, because again, our brain is the grand rationalizer when it's on its own. It just wants you comfortable and convenient. It doesn't want you vulnerable. So sometimes you need your friends there to remind you, hey, you told me you wanted to go drink water out of this well. I didn't tell you that. You told me that. And you're like, oh, right. I did say I wanted to go there. Thanks for reminding me. So, your own brain is fascinating.
And you could do it. You could do it with still being kind, right?
Absolutely. Like
even your friends that are being tough on you, or vice versa, you being tough on them, it can still be delivered with kindness. Sometimes people hear the term, be honest with people, and then they think in their head that means it's like point out like stuff in a way that's harsh. And it's like, there's a difference between harsh and direct.
That's right. And to your point, it's knowing and having that relationship be in a place that feedback is warranted and welcomed, and not having to qualify it. Like, if you're never the person that's ever given that tough love, right, after 10 years, and all of a sudden you're just like, whoa, where did that come from? And so
puts people on the defense.
That's right. And so the fact that I've given permission for my friends to hold me accountable, right? It's I wrote The Accountability Effect, the book, The Accountability Effect, in a 30-day challenge. I had this group goal setting called Calipara. And that was it. I made this commitment, and it was hell, Drew. I didn't want to write. I wanted to quit. I didn't want to write it anymore. But I said, you know what? I made this commitment to this group, and they're also leaning in on what they're doing. And I did it. And it was just amazing. Just the thought that I knew there were people there that I'd quote unquote let down, or I asked them to be my allies. And look, we all need help in life. That's the thing. Teammates, coaches, no one, you can't do things on your own. And so I think sometimes we as adults, we go through childhood. You have to get good grades, listen to your parents. You get to high school, it's okay, 4 years, and take your SATs, get into college. Then you get to college, it's all about getting a job. You get a job, and people think you have it figured out. Oh, great, you're an adult now. You got a job. Okay, solved. It's like, whoa. It's like the Utah salt flats of the rest of your life. You know, like, I didn't get a rule book. I didn't get a playbook. How am I supposed to do this? Throughout your whole life, you had coaches, teachers, friends. Now all of a sudden, we're supposed to know and figure it out. It's kind of crazy. So I think that's the biggest illusion about being an adult, is that, oh, you're an adult now, you have it solved. And I think what we all realize is, I'm about to be 40, Drew. And there's times in my head, I still feel like an 18-year-old kid. And so that's what your friends are there for. That's what people are there for, to help guide you and to put you back on that path, because we don't have it all figured out and we all stray. So this illusion that, oh, you're an adult, you got to figure it out, it's kind of an unfair burden on folks. So those friends are there to remind us and to nudge us back onto the path that you know, we had said that, you know, we stated for ourselves.
You know, one of the messages in conclusion of the book that you share is really, when you step into accountability, you go from hoping that something works out one day. And the tendency is, I've seen in my life, that when you're young, it's all about hope for the future. It's one day in the future. And then, interestingly enough, if anybody spend time with senior citizens or people at, you know, a nursing home, there's a lot of looking back in the past and sort of like a revisionist history, right? Yeah. Oh, when I was younger, you know, I was the best at this and I could have done that if that happened for me, mm. right? Because there's not any more future that's left for us. We have to change the past. And then on the extreme version is that if anybody spends some time with somebody on their deathbed or individuals on their deathbed, that's when a lot of the regrets come up because you can't hide anymore. Mm. You can't hide anymore. There's no more future. You know, if you do revisionist history on the past, you're not kidding anybody besides you know, yourself. So the regrets come out and it's like, I wish I would have done this. I wish I would have done that. And part of the way out of that cycle of putting so much of our attention on the future and taking away so much of our energy on the past and how the past happened or didn't happen and how that influenced today is getting out of hoping and getting into doing. So what's important for people to understand when it comes to going from hoping to now putting our direction to actually doing it? Like even taking this book as an example, when you wrote it in this 30-day challenge, how do you go from I hope to write one of this one day to actually I'm doing it now?
You know, for me, this might sound so funny and so simple. We all kind of pre-edit in our head. And I think there's an illusion that creating is, you know, a manifestation of what you discovered. But we realize that when we create, it's actually a discovery of what we're going to manifest, right? It's this knowledge that the fear will never go anywhere, right? It's the amateurs who are kind of like, I will start once I'm not afraid. Once I figured it out, then I'll start. But it's the pros who know that fear never leaves. You just have to find a way to start. So for me, whether it was the book or something else, I literally, because even to this day, as disciplined and as accountable and methodical as I am, I still have to put my phone on airplane mode. I have to set a timer for 30 minutes and I press go. And Drew, I promise you, 30 uninterrupted minutes of creating something is a lifetime. When there's no interruptions, would you just let yourself go where you don't edit, you allow yourself to create, you can write 1500, 2000 words. Like that about page that you've been thinking about writing for the last 3 months is done in 30 minutes. So I think what happens to us is we get paralyzed by the thing we say we want to do, right? That thing. Again, let's bring it back to that what. I want to be an accountant. I want to write a book. So it's this book that weighs on us. But that book gets written in 30-minute segments, right? It's you versus a blinking cursor. So when I sit down, I don't tell myself, I want to write this book. I say, I'm going to write for 30 uninterrupted minutes. So for me, it's shrinking that change and giving myself permission to explore. That's really it. And the understanding that I don't know what I'm going to write when I sit down. And that always shocks people. When they've read something I've written, they're like, oh my God, it's so well put together. I go, didn't start that way. No idea what I was going to write.
I think that's such an important point because I will say as an entrepreneur, and you know, you can chime in on this too. Sometimes I sit down and I'm working on a business concept. I'm putting an idea together. Even sometimes I'm so clear on what I thought and what it ends up being is something completely different and it becomes completely successful in a different way. And then there's other times, especially in the beginning of my career and still now, where I have a concept of sort of what I want to do, but I have no freaking clue. Like we're all just guessing and we're taking it day by day to do the best that we can. But you can write a book in that time. You can have a hit podcast in just figuring it out day by day. You can have a very successful company if you just keep on showing up every day and figuring it out one day at a time.
That's right. And know that the fear will never leave, right? There will always be this discomfort and this unknown. And I think for the quote unquote doers, and I don't want to separate doers and dreamers. I think it's on a spectrum, right? There's times where I'm a little bit more relaxed than doing, but that skill and that muscle of being cool with discomfort and not knowing what's on the other side. I'm always shocked, Drew, I swear. There are times where I'm like, do I want to write right now? Do I not want to write? Okay, let me do a 30-minute session. And even in a time where I just decided I didn't know what I was going to write, at the end of those 30 minutes, Drew, sometimes I'll look at it and go, holy shit, had I not sitting down to write, I might have never written the thing I just wrote. You know what I mean? Like, it had to come out because you had to give yourself permission to enter the fray, right? You got to enter that arena without knowing what's on the other side. So I think, again, as adults, I touched on it earlier, is I think we think we've been able to predict the tides and the seasons and the crops, that we think we can predict our own lives. And so we will pre-edit in our head, right? You write the first two sentences or go through your head for weeks before you write them down. Or I've talked to people and coached people who they want to start a blog, but they want to have the audience before they write because they have their best two posts in their head. And I said, look, your first 10 posts are for you. No one's going to read them. The interesting thing is what you write on your 11th post. You know, that's when it's kind of like, oh, now that you've gotten all these things that you've had in your mind out of the way, what's next? And so that doing, I think we put so much pressure on the finished product when, again, listen to what Drew said. I remember when you had this podcast, you told us how you got started and how you're like, guys, I don't know what I'm doing. I learned a little bit of this, learned a bit of this, and I leaned in. And so imposter syndrome is strong and we all feel like, well, who am I to do this? But can we change imposter syndrome and just call yourself a newbie, right? Just say, hey, I'm new at this. We're all imposters in that. Everybody was new at something. And so just say, hey, I want to learn. I'm new. You're not expected to be a pro yet. So I think a lot of us think, well, I'm an adult. I should be a professional at this. No, you're not. You're a newbie. And so just lean in 30 minutes at a time and some amazing things will happen on the other end.
Mm. Powerful words, my friend. Powerful words. You've created a bunch of really great things, and especially this ebook. It's free. It's out there. I even hesitate to call it an ebook. To me, it's just like a book. You know, it's a digital book, but they can get printed copies too. I think through. Can they get printed copies?
Yes, on Amazon. Yep, they can buy. They can buy a printed copy. Yep.
Yeah. So the accountability effect. You can find it in the show notes. But you know, this conversation isn't done. But I do want to give a very strong plug for this book, because even though it was written a few years ago, it's that timeless kick in the pants that we all need sometimes when it comes to wanting to take control back into our life. And I believe, Bassam, we can get it at yourfirstname.com, right? Bassam.com/
subscribe.
Subscribe.
Yeah.
And you can find that in the show notes. If you're listening, you can bookmark that on your phone, Bassam.com/subscribe. You can get that accountability effect. It's a fantastic book about, I love the subtitle, The Book Your Excuses Don't Want You to Read.
And, you know, a funny, and thank you for that, truly, the genesis of this, so people know, is I was in Southern California, didn't have a lot of money to my name, was working for a mortgage banking firm between 2005 and 2007, and I was supposed to be this sales rep. Anyway, made no money, was just about to start making money when the financial crisis happened. Lost my job in 2007, was in debt, like $80,000, kicking rocks. I was 27, like, oh Lord, you know, what have I done? And I had that moment where I don't know if it was a Tim Ferriss or Chris Guillebeau book. I was sitting in my bed and I said, Bassam, you're accountable for your own happiness. And it was one of those, call it, that was the moment, that fork in the road where I said, wait, I have a say in this, right? I am a part of this. And Bassam, you cannot put this weight on the world. So that was kind of the actual start of this, when I kind of just got obsessed with this word accountability. And I felt everyone sloughed away from it. It was this word that nobody liked to talk about because it's ugly and it's gray. And what do you mean accountable? So it started from this point of kind of feeling like I did not have control, and realized, wait a second, I do have control. I held on to that thread and just kind of kept pulling that yarn in. And that book was one of the things that came out on the other side.
Mm. Well, I'm glad you did it. And I think that's a great reminder for everybody, which is that it just takes one of those moments. You have one of those moments and you decide to approach it in a little bit of a different way. And sometimes that can be just hearing a conversation. It's like, wow, I've been wanting to do this thing. Who's to say that I can't do it? And you have a flip of the switch and you're like, great, let's make progress. And it changes the course of your life. Bassam, you've done that multiple times over. Let's talk about some of the other books that you have that are out there. Can you share with our listeners?
Yeah. So the second book I wrote on a similar kind of topic title. It's called In 5 Years, You'll Be Wrong. That book was also self-published, and it was sparked from this idea. I was doing a lot of speaking at universities, and I think I felt for the students there, right? I mean, especially I was born in 1980. I grew up in an analog world, which switched to digital as I got older. But a lot of these kids, the pressure from Entrepreneur magazine and Inc. magazine and everything, I got to pick, I got to do, I need to conquer. It was tough. And I felt for them. And I came up with this notion that all these kids were trying to predict what they wanted to be in life. And I said, look, you might think you want to be CEO of IBM, but that probably is never going to happen. Not because you're not talented enough, but you might hate IBM. You might fall in love. You might find out you're interested in something else, right? That illusionary goal you're hanging your hat on probably won't happen. So when people say, where do you want to be in 5 years? I always say living intentionally. I don't know. I want to make sure my ship has some provisions in it. I want to make sure my sail is seaworthy. I want to make sure I have no leaks, and I want to set out over the horizon paddling. But man, once I get over that horizon, there's a storm, there's an island, there's an iceberg I didn't see, and I'll have to change direction. So the book was 68 life lessons to help you jump in, calm down, stand out, and something else. I forget the title, but it's short lessons to help. It was mainly written for college kids to kind of be like, shrink that change. What's important? In 5 years, you'll be wrong. So it doesn't tell you to not start, but it tells you to not put on so much of this pressure of where you want to be. And I think what a lot of people do is that pressure so far in the distance is the reason why they don't get started. And I want to tell people, hey, just paddle in the cardinal direction and then change direction if you need to at some point. So that's a fun, punchy book as well. And then that book I had mentioned that Antonio had challenged me on, I did this wild journey from London, England to Ulaanbaatar, Mongolia in a 42 horsepower car, almost 10,000 miles. And I wrote a book about the experience, my personal, emotional, and physical experience I was dealing with. I had a company at the time. I didn't know if I wanted it anymore. And this drive to finish this rally, it's called the Mongol Rally. And the book is called Borders, Bandits, and Baby Wipes. And that got picked up, got published, which was a fun journey. And then I recently just gave a TEDx talk, kind of on the book, called 10,000 Miles of Planned Grit. So that book is kind of very near and dear to my heart. It was about me leaning into the discomfort of travel and, what we learn about ourselves, and each other, again, resilience and empathy, being out on the open road in places like Turkmenistan and Uzbekistan and Mongolia was a fascinating experience.
I love it, man. Well, Bassam, I want to thank you for coming on the podcast and talking about the great advice that you've put together in your material that I think that now more than ever can be super influential in terms of how we decide to take control of our lives and step into our goals and dreams, knowing that we have the power to impact them. You know, there's that classic sort of Steve Jobs quote, and I'll just paraphrase here, is that he thinks that most people just think that the world is the way that it is and somebody designed it on purpose. But when you actually realize that you can poke it, that you can push it, that you can move that world and you can shape it and you can help determine how it looks, then it completely changes how you relate to the actual world itself. And I think this conversation is a nudge in that right direction. So I want to thank you for your work and joining us on the Broken Brain Podcast.
Thank you, sir. It's been a pleasure. I'm an avid listener, and I hope this conversation helps people to, again, get out of our own way, to not put the pressure on ourselves, and just to be accountable for our own happiness and just start.
Hi, everyone. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Just a reminder, this podcast is for educational purposes only. This podcast is not, I repeat, it's not a substitute for professional care by a doctor or otherwise qualified medical professional. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. If you're looking for help in your journey, seek out a qualified medical practitioner. If you're looking for a functional medicine practitioner, you can visit ifm.org and search there, find a provider database. It's important that you have somebody in your corner that's qualified, that's trained, that's a licensed healthcare practitioner helping you make changes, especially when it comes to your health.